Hello and welcome. I am your host, Neil Ward, and I'm grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators' paths to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with Associate Professor of Graphic Design, Sarah McCoy, from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Let's listen in. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Thank you for being on Tell It to Neil.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's get into it. How did you get into design?
Well, I think it started as a child, really. I spent a lot of my time drawing and lettering. I would say I've always been interested in letters, typography. So I started making like little cards for my family and neighbors, and I kind of just did that all the time. And then I think around into second grade or third grade, there was like a summer school class that my mom signed me up for a calligraphy class. And so I loved it. I like had the little nibs and I was learning different shapes of letters, and I had so much fun. So I kept up doing that. And then I think all through high school I took design courses. I was always interested in art history as well. I think just the historical past. So I think that has followed me with my love of like historical letter forms in the past as well. But then I went to the University of Iowa and I majored in, let's see, graphic design and art education. And so I did both of the courses simultaneously, like my art courses and then my education classes. And then there was a moment where I had to take a type class or an education class, and I think you know which way I went. I think I
Oh,
took the
yes.
type class, and I think I called my parents. I said, "I'm not going to be an art ed major anymore. I'm going full on graphic design." And they were like, "What is that?" So it was a relatively new field. This was I entered the University of Iowa fall of 1995, so of course the computer was new. I think we shared two iMacs in the art department, like in the
Ooh.
graphic design department. Yeah, we like signed up for slots. And then I declared journalism as a minor area because they had some fun design and typography courses, and they also had a pretty they had a nicer computer lab, so I would hang out there and send my job to print, which took forever. So I love design, and I love thinking about color, composition, typography. And I think the difference was the reason I wasn't like a studio major was that I really liked communicating a specific thing. So giving ideas like meaningful form. I'm not saying that studio artists aren't communicating a specific thing because they are many times with their work. But I liked the idea of working with someone to create work that communicated something that they needed done. And I think to this day, that's the part that really gets my brain going is when I have a project with a client and they have a problem or a set of information that they want to have conveyed, and then having me work through it or helping them work through it, like, is this a digital project? Is this a printed project? I like thinking about the best solution for them. So I think at the heart of it, I'm still sort of this problem solver, but not at all in the way that my engineering husband is a problem solver. So mine is much more with color and image and depth and interest, how things are conveyed visually.
Absolutely. And design can kill people too, just like bad engineering could kill people.
This is true. This is true. It can. You might walk off onto a tarmac where you shouldn't be because you read the sign wrong, right? So, yeah, I do. I think that is an interesting part of our job as designers, which is different from, fine artists or studio artists, is that we're solving a problem. The idea of solving a problem is more forefront to what we're trying to do.
Do you think that it's more problem solving for people's needs or just problem solving for the particular problem that presents itself?
Could be both. Like my own, since I do letterpress printing, usually they want to convey, generally something happy. I mean, I do print some things that are, have to do with sympathy and things like that, but they come to me because they want to give visual to a specific event or thing or time, moment in time or something. And so I think that's an interesting part of my job, you know, is to, they don't come, I mean, some of the things they're doing might be a want, but for the most part, it's a need that they have, that they need to have, they need help with.
Absolutely. And that's what makes our field so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think about the different clients I work with, and they've been, you know, universities and bike companies, but then they've also been corporate projects. So the gamut's wide, you know, and then, you know, it's like creating stationery for you or your mom or, you know, so yeah. The range, I think I also really like that part about my field is that I don't have necessarily one specific client. I mean, I have, you know, repeat clients and certain clients, but I love being able to help someone with a problem they have that they can't design it themselves or they don't have the tools to do that. And I'm happy to, I like being a part of someone's help or solution.
It is very rewarding.
Yeah,
definitely. After you graduated with your undergrad, what happened at that point? Did you go directly into a graduate program or did you go out and work in the field?
I at the end of my time with my BA in graphic design, I went to Austin, Texas in 1999, and I worked for a small company that managed a bunch of associations of Texas. So I did like newsletters and brochures, and this is when the internet was still fairly not prevalent, right? I mean, it was emerging. It was emerging. So everyone was trying to figure out what to do with it. So I still had a lot of print projects. So I learned how to get projects to press and things like that. And I worked for a pretty small company, and there weren't a lot of people my age. And so I kind of started looking for a new job. My pay was kind of bad. It was like the same as what I had made the summer before in an internship in Chicago. So I was looking for a little better pay, a little better benefits, and really, to be honest, looking to be a part of a little something bigger than me and trying to find a better design community, you know? At that time, Austin did have a AIGA. I think I didn't know how to go about networking or really join that. So, like, if I were to go back in time and talk to my younger self, I would have been like, go right to those, go to all the socials of AIGA Austin and meet people. Because I think that would have helped me find my newer job, the job I eventually took sooner. And I would have felt more a part of the design community. You know, you kind of moved to a whole new town. I moved from Iowa City, Iowa to Austin, Texas, and I didn't know anyone. And my husband had a job as an engineer, and so he had a bunch of young people he worked with. So we did a lot of hanging out with them, but my office, I think everyone, you know, here I was 22, 23, and the rest of the people in my office were like 40 and up, and, you know, just a different place in life. So I did a lot of interviewing, and I wound up taking a job that October with National Instruments, which was a hardware and software company in Austin, Texas, and that was their headquarters, and they were based throughout the world as well. So I had a lot of interesting projects to do. Product design, like box design, product design. I did a fun billboard, lots of other just catalog pages. Some we were starting to put things on the web, so resizing some things that was emerging. A lot of advertisements still, and like kind of technical publications. So I loved it though because I was with, like, I think our corporate design group had 20 other designers. Or at least like,
wow,
group. Like maybe 18 designers. And then we had a photographer, we had an archivist who was like taking care of all of our, images of all the products and things, some art director, that would include our art director and creative director, but, it was great. And it was such a flourishing environment for me as a young designer. They paid for us to be AIGA members. They wanted us to, be active that way. So it was just a great place as a young designer to just grow. So I was there from 99 till 2001. And then that May, my husband and I quit our jobs and we traveled abroad a bit. And then that fall, my husband started graduate school, and I had thought about it, but we weren't sure if like both of us could afford to be a student, you know, and not work. And we weren't really sure financially how to all make it work. So we kind of moved, and Andy had a research assistantship, and I looked for a new job. So I worked locally in Iowa City for Corcoran Communications doing design for them, which they did a bunch of publications for, small private colleges and universities. So I did all kinds of lookbooks, if you will. And ooh, that fall, then I thought, you know, maybe I want to go back to graduate school. So I applied that fall, and then I started that January. So January of 2002, I entered graduate school. You'll laugh, like the first class I signed up for was Intro to Letterpress Printing. I'd always wanted to take it as an undergrad. And I was like, I'm going to take that class. And then, and I loved my design seminar, and I can't even remember the other. I think I took about 3 courses a semester, and then I worked as a teaching assistant quarter time, and then half time research assistant. I worked for international programs, so I did all the design for all their different international speakers and events, and I loved that because it was such a broad range of, you know, speakers from Bosnia and Ghana, and so the visuals were fantastic. So I did newsletters and publications for them all the while I was in graduate school. So at the time, I wasn't exactly sure, like, the, you know, what was going to be my thesis, what was my area of interest in graduate school, but I just thought I'd just start because I always liked talking about design, thinking about design. And I found that even in our, when I was back in Austin, when we'd have critiques, I find myself talking about like why I used the type I did and why I did what I did more so than maybe some of my other colleagues. So there was some kind of spark there of like the whys and the hows of design.
And it just came so natural to you too, which is really awesome.
I think it was helpful that I worked for a few years and then did graduate school only in that like, I had hit deadlines, had to deal with clients, had to deal with projects that didn't go well, that did go well. You know, like I had the gamut of kind of all the situations, like how to get something approved through the approval process and, you know, in the corporate world. And so all those things I think really did help me as a, you know, back in graduate school, I kind of treated grad school more like a job. Like, you know, I went to my classes, did my work, during the day, kind of like a job, you know, and then I'd come home and do my homework at night. So I think it was a good chance to like separate from how, you know, a lot of lounging that took place during undergraduate. So, you know, it helped me kind of focus that way, I guess, if that makes sense.
That's so funny. You use the term lounging.
Well, you know, there was a little more downtime in the undergrad world. I think I had a like kind of nannied for a family, you know, and but the you know, here I was having to show up at my other job, then leave it, go to class, and maybe come back to my job, you know. So, you know, I think that was helpful in getting me kind of thinking that way more, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you were in your graduate program, did you have a graduate assistantship with that, or was
I
this
did.
Just, okay.
Yeah, so I was a quarter-time TA, so I helped with graphic design 1. And then the other half time. So I pretty much worked 3/4 time is what my assistantship was, and that so that other half time was over there at international programs. And I was in international programs for like 3-4 years, I think, because at Iowa you do your MA, and then after 2 more years you get like your MFA. It's kind of a weird. I don't know, you get an MA along the way of getting an MFA, if that makes sense.
Okay.
I was also in the Center for the Book graduate certificate program. Now you can actually get an MFA at the University of Iowa Center for the Book, but when I was there, they didn't have that. You could just get a graduate certificate, which you still did your body of work or thesis work in that. So I basically was working on 2 programs at once. And so after I finished my MFA in 2005, I had 1 more year left with my graduate certificate program at the Center for the Book. So in that last year I shifted and I worked at the University of Iowa Museum of Art as their graphic designer. And I shifted to work there because I thought it would be more exciting to do more signage, if that makes sense. and kind of a few bigger exhibition things, but which it was good. The work was good and interesting, although I had more flexibility and I had a little bit more freedom at the international programs position. So I did find that out later. So I always tell students, like, now if you find a job where you have good freedom and creative license, that could trump a job that has more prestige or you would appear to have more interesting work. When I had to really, like, the gallery director had a kind of specific aesthetic I had to follow. So I kind of traded one thing for another, and, you know, it all worked out fine. But looking back, I should have stayed at probably international programs.
Yeah.
I had a really awesome boss, Lois, who was awesome, and she just gave me freedom to do things, and she was just awesome, and I traded it for a more intense boss. So looking back, Lois was number one.
Well, I mean, that just goes to show that, you know, every opportunity that comes along is never perfect. There's always something that's not exactly what you want, but you can compromise.
Totally.
And yeah. So then what did you, what was your thesis project about? Now, did you do a project in lieu of thesis, or did you do a paper?
Both. I did a body of work and then I had to write it. So, that's what Iowa. But my MA work built upon my MFA work, if that makes sense. So I wasn't starting all over again.
Yeah.
My interest at the time, and it still kind of is, I was interested in current events. And at the time, Flash was a newly emerging technology. So I was interested in making, I called them digital response collages. So I would, every day I would find a news story, and then I would respond to that news story with text and image that would like move and convey the information instead of like steps, you know, like in an animation. And so some of them were humorous news stories and others were really specific. I mean, this was during weapons of mass destruction time. So I had a lot of news stories to work with. So every day I'd find a collage and I'd make imagery, and then I would physically print everything out, like from the computer, and like mess around on a blank piece of paper with them. And so I would make the collages, and then I would scan them and digitize them and then activate them in Flash, if that makes sense. So there was an interesting part about, you know, like the news story I chose, I tried to be objective, if that makes sense. So I did try to find news stories that were not like slanted one side or the other, if that makes sense. So I wanted to try to show the again, as a designer, it was my job to like present the information as best as I could without trying to say my take, if that makes sense. But of course, visually, I was making decisions, you know, on how to visually present the work. But my goal wasn't to try to like promote one side or the other, if that makes sense. But it was trying to be more neutral in the presentation of the information. So, which is funny now, like in light of all the fake news, right? Like, wow, I guess I was ahead of my time. Again, like I think I did a news story about monks that were making beer out of washing machines, like, and then I would do one on like that they did or didn't find weapons of mass destruction, you know. So I mean, like, it was all the gamut. Again, it was like whatever that day I found interesting, but I wanted to challenge myself one to find something every day and respond to it. So I was kind of in this process of every day, you know, and some collages turned out to be fantastic and others turned out to be just kind of okay, right? But I went through the process every day of making them. While I was doing them, I was researching and looking at futurist page spreads. So you know how expressive the futurist work was. Now, of course, they ended up, you know, kind of being co-opted by various governmental agencies. But
yeah.
But the way that their pages were super active and the typography was really expressive. That was one of the things I was trying to do more. You know, I'd come out of working in a corporate environment where everything was, I had a brand standard. So I really wanted to step away from the computer. And like, while I generated things through that, then I would print it out and rip them up and layer it and work through kind of unique ways of working.
Yeah. So Dadaists would have gone a little too far.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at Dada work too. I think I just had a couple of futurist books, and so I was looking at that. And then I had been in, this sounds so glamorous, but I had been in Rome and I had seen a futurist show. So I just was kind of influenced by their approach, if you will. So,
well, yeah, and what better context to see that all in too?
Yeah. So, I still have a little soft spot for all the futurist typography. So, and yeah, Zhang Tum Tum is still part of my life. No Netty. So,
yes. Well, so then you graduated, and I guess my next question is, when was the aha moment where you knew that design education might be for you?
Well, like I said, I really enjoyed teaching. As my teaching assistant, I really enjoyed that. And I just liked talking and thinking about design, and I like looking at student work and helping them and watching them grow. So, you know, looking back, I started as an art ed major, right? I like education side of things, but I just, the thought of, you know, doing clay every day in a high school just it brought me down. nothing against my ceramicists and... but I, you know, I think, so then all of a sudden the aha moment was like, oh, well, maybe I could teach graphic design. So I did look, for graphic design positions, but I wasn't really looking at other design, you know, just regular design jobs, but I could have, I just was kind of interested in teaching. I thought I hadn't done that yet. I mean, I had been a teaching assistant, but I hadn't like, you know, led full classes, full syllabi, like for a whole semester. You know, I mean, I had dipped my toe into it, but I hadn't done it in a big way, right? Like three courses, you know, whatever. And so I don't know. I just applied for a bunch of different teaching positions, and I applied. I had quite a few interviews. I think I was young and earnest at the time, so I was number two in a lot of them. Just because I barely looked older than I think the students. And so that was one of the challenges, you know, and they'd be like, well, how would you handle this situation in an interview? And I'm like, well, I'll be new to that and I'll try, you know? So I think I was probably fairly young and earnest. I interviewed at like West Virginia and University of Minnesota at Duluth and Pacific Lutheran in Seattle, or Tacoma area. And
wow. All amazing. Geographic locations.
Yep, I was pretty open, and my husband was open to, you know, he had done his PhD in civil engineering, so he could have easily gone the fellowship route or academic route. He chose, again, sort of similar to me, he kind of wanted to be doing the work every day and problem solving, so he stayed in more of a consulting role, and that's where he still is now, but he was open to moving, and so he interviewed all over in like Maryland and San Francisco, and the one place we both like overlapped was Des Moines, and we're from near here, so I did remember thinking on a plane ride, I think I had to go from Iowa City to Chicago and then Chicago to Tacoma on that interview, and I remember thinking like, you know, our families are in the Midwest. Like, we would do this route, like, once a year maybe to, like, visit family or they come see us. But I was thinking, like, maybe the Midwest is all right. You know, I loved our time in Austin, and I'd still go back to Austin. It's totally different now from when it was 21 years ago when we lived there. and I still have friends who ask me about where they should eat there, and I'm like, I have no idea. Like, it's all changed. But I loved the – when we moved there, Austin felt like Iowa City and Des Moines, because it had all the like governmental things and it had a big university, and so it felt like a big like Iowa City and Des Moines kind of feel, and now it has a whole different, that doesn't feel like that anymore. It's like a tech hub now, so it's a totally different, you know, when we left there, people were starting to move there from California, but no one else was moving there from, like, you know, New York or Nashville. You know, it was just a different time. So I would go back, but our house, the house we had there has been, like, is like five times the price we paid for it. And they built, like, three times the size onto it. So we wouldn't even recognize our old neighborhood, I think. We lived in Central Austin, and now I don't think we could even afford to move back to the whole home we bought initially. So, but anyway, Des Moines is where we overlapped, and we thought, well, you know, yeah, maybe in the future we might have kids, and being near our families would be nice for that. And it turned out to be really nice to be there. And Des Moines is a great town. It's affordable, and everybody's friendly, and it's great. Our, you know, our normal rush hour is what, 15-20 minutes?
Yeah.
From about 5:15 from about 5:15 to 5:45 it's busy around Des Moines. I remember Austin, even back in 1999, rush hour started at like 3 to 7, you know, and it sucked. So I don't miss that.
Oh wow. Yeah, I wouldn't either.
No, so
continuing with the narrative here, so you were applying all over the country for these for graphic design jobs, and how did you land at Drake?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Drake was wasn't even a full time position; it was visiting at the time. But I think Andy and I thought we tried out, and I think there was a point where we in the interview they were talking about how it's visiting, but it would go into full time if that worked out or whatever. So. I don't know. It just turned out to be a good spot for us. I think the thought of Duluth, the folks at Duluth were pretty awesome, but I was trying to picture winter there, and that's really far north, and I knew, like, there'd be months out of the year we wouldn't go anywhere. Hey, look now, we're in quarantine. We're not going anywhere. But I just was like, oh, for a bunch of months out of the year, Duluth's really awesome. And then there's, like, 6 months where it's really cold and dark. So I had an offer there, and I chose Des Moines over it. And I'm glad I did. It's been a good fit for me. But the other thing in the back of my mind was that I wanted to open up a letterpress studio and have a place to work and print. And I knew, like, Tacoma, that might be harder with rent, you know, and just higher rent there. We knew, like, for Andy, San Fran, that was just going to be in our house, you know, so that wasn't ever going to be an option to have a studio in San Francisco. So that was in the back of our minds about things. And we thought, well, maybe Des Moines would be affordable to do that. So, between a good job for both of us and family nearby and the option to have a studio, you know, we really thought that could be, it could be good.
And what a great decision that was.
Indeed. Indeed. And it's worked out great. And I don't think I could be doing the same thing I'm doing in a different place, you know, like being able to teach some days and work in the studio some days and then have a mix on other days. And, you know, it works for now.
Well, so I'd like to go back just a little bit. And you had mentioned that starting at Drake, you were in a visiting position, which I'm guessing a lot of our listeners might be in that boat or might be in that capacity. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, going from a visiting professor into a tenure track role.
Sure.
And how that transition kind of happened.
Sure. It was so funny. Like, every other day I felt like they were like, you know, this is visiting, right? I'm like, I do. So I would say, you know, if I were in the position of being a full-time faculty member and I had an awesome visiting person visiting, I probably wouldn't tell that to them like every other day. It really didn't help me feel a part of things, to be honest. But I just figured, you know, with Andy's role, he was in Des Moines, but they had a lot of offices everywhere else in the country. So we both thought that, like, if it didn't pan out, we would just, he could either stay in Des Moines and I'd figure it out, or, you know, we'd just move then. So, you know, I think it freaked everybody out at Drake when we bought a house. But we had bought a house in Austin, and we had bought a house in Iowa City and kept selling it. And, you know, now I think if I were to do it, I don't think we would have bought a house. I think we would have just rented. But I had my letterpress equipment, and so we kind of wanted a house to stick it in, you know, like a garage and things. But looking back now, I probably would have said, like, okay, get an apartment and then just get a storage unit or get a studio and pay the rent on the studio, just sign a shorter lease or something. You know, I think I probably would have done it a little differently. And, you know, the housing market has since then been a lot more volatile than it was during the years of grad school and our time in Austin. So I would give that advice for sure. But I just tried to do a really good job, and then I figured I would just apply. Because I think I came in, and this will be familiar for many people, I think I came in and it had been a failed search. So they were just in a position where they really just needed someone to step in. I think, Neil, that John was actually on sabbatical when I stepped in.
Possibly.
And I think I came in and I was like, oh, it's me and some part-timers. I think we had, I don't really remember.
I think it was
two adjuncts and me. I was the full-time visiting, which I remember the seniors were like asking me a lot of questions about graduation stuff, and I had no idea, so I had to figure that out fast. And to this day, sometimes I feel like I kind of missed the normal, like, introduction into a department because people were on sabbatical. I just kind of stepped in. It was a little chaotic. So I came in, and I think it was a failed search. I was visiting for 1 year, and then they were going to start the search again. So I knew I could at least apply, you know. So I just figured I'd kind of go and get some experience, and, you know, it seemed all right. So I did that, and then I applied for the position. And I was one, and then they had someone else, and boy, I don't really remember the other person's interviewer. I don't really remember any of that. It seems so long ago. It's like 14 years ago. And so somehow I got the job, I guess. But I don't think I was the first choice. And I think the dean told me that, like, which I'm not sure. I think they were like, it's okay to be second choice. And I was like, oh, I guess I didn't know I was second choice. So one thing I would say is, like, just try not to take all these things personally, right? Because, like, multiple times I was told it was visiting, right? Which made me feel like they were saying, we don't want you here, but you're our only option, right? So I just tried to, like, move forward and enjoy my time and, like, the people that I work with. So that's a good... I would say just let things roll off your back. Try not to get into the political stuff and all that. So, and then I was in the tenure track, and I was in that for 5 years, I think. And then in my fifth year, I had my second baby. I had my first baby after, let's see, I started fall of 06, and my daughter arrived spring of 2008. So I did kind of a weird... 2 week maternity leave, and then I came back part-time. I did like an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, which I wouldn't advise anyone, and I didn't have an actual good maternity leave. I don't know why they didn't do that, but they didn't present that as an option, so I don't know. Anyway, looking back now, I would fight differently, and now looking back, there's a much bigger maternity leave that they have now. And so looking back, maybe I should ask for that time back, huh? And then in 2011, February, I had my second daughter, and I was running my studio out of my home, my letterpress studio, doing work for clients. And I had Gemma, and it was just all a lot. And I don't know. I just lost interest in the grind of it all, I think. And so I just said, I'm going to resign from my tenure track position.
Oh, no, my. Well, I mean, your and priorities
my
shifted.
Priorities had shifted. I felt like I was running in 20 different directions. I had two small kids, you know, three and a newborn. And I was doing client work, which I loved and I didn't want to let go of. And I don't know. You know, Neil, some of the things that get said to you before tenure, like, well, maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't, you know, and it was just all like a, And I just, it was, seemed like a big mountain to climb, and I had been doing fine, but I still don't think I think my drive had just shifted. My priorities had just shifted. So I resigned, and then I came back and I taught one class because they needed me to. And I really still enjoyed teaching. You know, it's not like I think it was just the grind of like the reviews and the thought of going the whole writing the tenure narrative seemed long. I don't know. It just all, I don't know. Anyway, so that was that. And then in the spring semester, they said, hey, could you teach two classes instead of just one? I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And then I started looking at what my pay was as an adjunct for two classes versus full-time pay for three classes. And I was like, wow, maybe I should just go back to full-time.
Yeah, like, it's a big contrast.
It's huge contrast. I mean, it wasn't, by the time I actually paid childcare when I was doing the one class and showing up, I think I brought home like $200, you know, all said and done. It was worthless. But I enjoyed the students, and I enjoyed getting out, and I enjoyed teaching. And so, you know, I started to think about, like, you know, adjuncting was kind of nice with the stage of life I had because I didn't have to go to a ton of meetings and things like that, which helped, you know.
Yeah.
With having small kids. But, you know, as once Gemma got to be about three and Charlotte was in elementary school, it was getting a little bit easier. And so I just was like, well, shoot, maybe I should just apply for my old job. So I did. I just applied for my old job. And I think they were all like, whoa, why? And I'm like, well, I was already teaching two classes. It's just one more. And the pay and the benefits are a lot better.
Yeah.
So, and I did miss some of the different feeling connected to campus. So then I applied back. But I would say, you know, it was a real long shot getting my old job back. It's not a route I would tell everyone to go, you know. I think I knew worst case scenario, I would just go back to a design job then, you know, or running my studio. So I wasn't out much by not applying, you know. It was like, well, I'll just throw my hat in, and if it's meant to be, I'll be there, and if not, then it's not. And, you know, I loved seeing students grow from when they come in to when they leave. It's just amazing, and you don't get that in your normal design job, which, you know, that was part of the thrill of, and it still is for me, watching students grow. So I thought it'd be wise to just try again, and if not, then it wasn't meant to be, and I'd just go a different direction, so...
Yeah, well, and I'm going to make a huge assumption here, and I think I'm on point. to those that are listening, this is where it pays off to be nice to everybody.
Oh yeah.
And to be collegial and to be cordial to everybody and do your best, even though the situation may or may not warrant it, because in the future you never know where you're going to be, and you may have to rely on the people that you worked with to help you.
Totally. And I don't think round two, when I came back from my old job, even though I was currently doing the job and doing it well, I don't know if I was a finalist. Like, I think I did a phone interview, but I don't think I got the on-campus interviews, if I recall. And I thought, oh, okay, so I guess I'm going to finish this semester and mosey on. And that's not how it happened. I think it went a different direction, and then I was called in to do a presentation and do an on-campus interview. And so again, I would say to see it through, you know, regardless of how it was going to pan out, I was just going to finish well the semester. And then if, you know, that was done, then I was done, you know? And, there was multiple times I could have burned those bridges, I think, and I didn't. You just never know. It's the same thing with your own design jobs. You know, you do a job for a client, and I had one snafu job, which was something I don't do in house. So I sent it out of the house to have done, and it didn't come back correct. And they didn't see the extra flaw until they had sent all the invitations out, and nor had I. We were all awed by the, and I should have seen it. I didn't. And so I paid for the entire mistake, even though it really wasn't fully my responsibility, right? Like,
they, no. You know what I mean?
And yeah. And you know, a year ago they came back and I did another project for them and it went great and I saw everything through and I kept everything in house. I don't do painted edges and different things, and so it was a different job, and now I've also learned from that kind of thing that when it's something that I don't do a lot of or it's not my wheelhouse, just to send them somewhere completely different and say, hey, go here, they'll handle you well, which is what I should have done, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to do the parts I should. Yeah. Anyway. So I've learned to say no when I should say no. I've learned to say yes when I should say yes. I've learned not to burn bridges because you never know. Plus, you never know who they know, right? Like,
That's the bigger key there.
Right. Like, they might talk to somebody like, oh, yeah, we're thinking about interviewing so-and-so. And then, and you were a big, you know, not nice person to them. They're not going to say anything good for you, right? So I just, and I've tried to go through life being a peacemaker and not one who stirs the pot. So maybe it's my middle child syndrome / Gen X. You know, that's just who I am. But I think it's helpful. You just never know. And so you should always try to end on the best terms that you possibly can, you know. I mean, there's people who I won't pick up projects for because it just is gone, ooh, and I don't want to deal with them again. But I'll say it in a nice way, like, you know, I'm not able to take that project on right now, you know. But I just try not to burn any bridges because you never know.
Absolutely. Well, so kind of in the interest of time, I'm going to speed through and let our listeners know that you were on the tenure track route. You went up for promotion and tenure, and you were promoted a year ago?
2018. Two years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I got to get back in gear here. I know, right? I think I might have took about a year off to kind of like, oh, I got through all that.
That's what I'm feeling right now.
Yeah. And it does take about a year to like decompress. And now I've got some ideas for new research projects and things. So I feel more energetic again. But yeah, it does. It's draining. And, you know, and I think I had a good friend from a completely different institution weigh in and read my things, which was helpful. I also had someone from Drake who is not in my department at all, completely different department. Mm-hmm. Look over my things and give some thoughts and feedback because they knew the environment at Drake. And they had been very successful at tenure, so they were a good sounding board as well.
Absolutely. Yes, that is very good advice, having someone outside of your department to review your work or writing anyway.
But they kind of know Drake's environment and kind of people and everything. So that was helpful. I think she could help me. Hey, don't forget to talk more about this or that. So that was good.
Well, so I want to kind of circle back. So throughout this whole time, and, you know, we're talking from early 2000s to 2020. So a 20-year block of time.
Thanks for making me feel old, Neil.
Oh, I'm right there with you. Don't worry. But during this time, you were working towards tenure. You were starting a family, and you had a letterpress company. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that trajectory of it.
Yeah, I started the letterpress company, the Permanent Collection, from my basement with a good friend from grad school. Actually, we started it together. He was in Iowa City. I was in Des Moines, so I was the Des Moines branch. He was the Iowa City branch. And we'd have printing parties at my house on the weekends, and we'd create a line of cards and things like that. But and then after, about a year or two, it was just challenging to have Brad further away. And so we just decided to, like, he was just going to be done from the company, which was fine. We're still really good friends to this day, so there's no hard feelings. We didn't have any massive blowout. He just got challenging with his own life situation. So he went one route, and then I kept going. And so I did work mostly for family and friends, and then friends would tell other friends, and their friends would tell other friends. So I just kind of did word of mouth. I never advertised, never had an actual business plan, which I would suggest highly to all people, but it's like, so it slowly evolved. My husband has been really helpful at, like, he helped file all the small business paperwork and taxes and all that kind of thing. And to this day, he helps me pay my sales tax and payroll tax and make sure I have insurance for right things. And so he does a lot of the bit. We call him businessman, and I am creative services on all other levels.
I love that.
It's really helpful to have someone else to help. I mean, I can only imagine, like, if I was wearing all the hats of, like, you know, running all the business side of things. And then, you know, I do have an accountant that does our taxes because it's just too challenging with everything. But so I did everything out of my house from the beginning. So 2006, we founded the company. Well, I think January of 2007, the actual paperwork went through. We founded the company. And then I was in my garage and basement for that entire time. And then in 2015, I moved to a freestanding studio. The purpose was in 2015... a couple pronged. One, if I didn't get tenure, I'd have a place and we'd have established it and maybe it could make a go. Two was to get all the stuff out of my house because it was getting challenging to, like, you know, we couldn't use our garage. The basement was overflow and it was just challenging. So, and then thirdly, people were asking me, why were you moving out of your house? Why were you opening a studio? And we're like, I don't really know. I'm just going to have a space. And all the while, I thought of two reasons of why I wanted a space. One, so I had more visibility. And two, so I could do fun stuff like host parties and things, which I haven't done as much of. But it's fun to, like, I hosted a guy, a printer from England that came by. And just stuff that I could do, you know, outside my house. So one of the impetuses before getting the studio was that I had a woman come to one of my open houses at my house, which is what I used to do. Mm-hmm. For friends and family, and she just saw that I had it on Twitter, and she drove down from Ames and came to my house, and that's when Andy was like, we had a complete stranger in our house. This we cannot do. Yeah. So I started looking for a place, and there were multiple places around Des Moines. I actually talked to, like, a commercial real estate person, and, like, all the rent was, like, hideously high, like, you know, $3,000 a month, which I'm sure if anyone hearing this on a coast is like, what, $3,000, that's nothing. But to Des Moines, that's a lot. And if you're selling $5 cards and $20 prints and doing the occasional custom projects, which it's not as occasional now, I do a lot of custom projects, but, you know, yeah. I mean, if you just do the simple math of, like, what if I get nothing for custom and I'm just selling cards? Well, I don't know how you're paying rent. A $3,000 rent, that's moving a lot of carts, right?
Well, yeah.
So I looked for, like, 2 years to find the right. So in 2012, we really started to kind of think about moving out of our, like, moving it out of our house. And I started looking for places. And, you know, I thought about Valley Junction, and which is close to my house. But at the time, it had kind of a different vibe than it does now. Now more places are moving there that are hipper, if you will. But one of the bonuses to being in the East Village, which is downtown Des Moines, is that my husband's office is a couple blocks away, so he can come down and, like, help out over lunch or man the shop or do different things. So that, and it's kind of a fun place with a lot of foot traffic, so that seemed like a good place. And then I had a good landlord who gave me kind of, like, a slower growing rent. Does that make sense? So, like, I came in at a smaller rent that, like, slowly built up. So it kind of would grow as I grew, which was really helpful. So, you know.
And what a great incubation model, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I would say, I would remind people that I was in my house for, like, 9 years before I moved out, you know. And so it was scary to take on rent. And, like, and then you remember, Neil, we used to not have internet down at the shop.
Yep.
let's see. We basically paid for, like, lights, like, electric, and that was about it, you know. Like, I didn't have a point of sale in the shop. I just used Intuit, which was, like, Square but cheaper.
Yeah.
Andy did all the research, and Square costs too much for us. So, you know, and I did farmers markets. I did a lot of events to get my name out there and be at, like, different pop-up shops and things. And then when we were going to go get the point of sale, we were open for, like, 2 years without a point of sale. I asked all my fellow merchants around the East Village, like, what point of sale they used and what were the good and bad points of things. And so they were all really helpful too. Like, fellow retailers are really good at, like, asking a lot of questions to and being friends with, because they, and then they're like sweet to like, oh, have you been around the corner to see Sarah's shop? You know, go see the permanent collection, you know? And so we all do that with each other in the East Village too. We're kind of a nice tight knit community. So it's really fun, like, you know, being a part of a fun community, which when I first moved in, I thought it would be fun to be in the East Village, but now it's like super fun. And I know a lot of the retailers down here and they're just fun. It's fun to be a part of, you know, a vibrant part of our downtown Des Moines scene.
Yeah, and being a part of that community is so fun, and stopping by to see you
on
a Sunday afternoon.
I love visitors. I know. It's fun. And then we slowly built the website up too, which, you know, right now we're in quarantine, and so that's been super helpful.
And what is the URL for the website?
I'm www.thepermanentcollection.net. So, and you can, what's nice is that, you know, I would say that took a long time too, to like photograph everything, write all the product pages. And so don't underestimate the amount of time that that kind of thing takes. And I kind of laughed because some of the local leaders were like, oh, well, just turn your brick and mortar East Village shops to an online shop. And I'm like, yeah, well, that takes time and money, which is hard for small business people, you know? So I would say all the while, keep building the other parts to your business that even if they don't seem important at the time or time consuming, you just never know. Like, I'm so glad it took us like 3 years to get the website. Like we would slowly keep adding inventory to it and checking inventory. And we've had some bumps along the way. Like, I've sold something I didn't have, you know, like it was on the web. We forgot to turn it off that when we sold it, and getting inventory to talk, that way. And you're like, oh, it's all a learning curve. And so, but like now it's been really helpful because it's been helpful to sustain business that way, you know, during this hard time with not being able to have my doors open. So.
Yes, I'm so glad that you're talking about running a business while working towards tenure, while raising a family, while doing all this other stuff.
I mean, I have to try to remind people that like it's all like small steps turn into big steps. So like, you know, that first draft of your narrative, just do it. It's going to be really ugly. It's going to be poorly written, probably, right? But just, like, get it down. Just, like, one of the things I would say is I'm very good about carving time for certain things. Like, this is my time to do this. This is my time to do this. This is my, you know, if I have 15 minutes at home before I'm going to shift to something else, then I start the load of laundry. Like, it's not fun. But I try to use, like, be really efficient with time blocks. So, like, on days when I'm on campus, I try to see all my students then, you know. But if I need to make time to see a student, I make sure to block it before I go down to the studio, you know. Or tell the students, hey, I'm at the studio all day here. You totally come see me here if you want to talk to me about something. But trying to be efficient with blocking your time, that, like, you know, carving, like, okay, I'm going to carve an hour or 2 hours every Monday to work on my tenure stuff. Like, I'm going to take photos. I'm going to write the captions for my images. I'm going to write this chapter, or I'm going to write about, you know, like I did small chunks, like, okay, I'm just going to write about 2006 to 2010, a 4-year time period. I'm going to write that chunk in my narrative today.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, like, just break it, you know, as the other teachers say, just break it down into small tasks, and then they turn into big tasks, you know, eventually, or they amount to something a lot more, you know.
Yeah.
It's the same with the shop. People come in and they're like, wow, look at all this stuff you've printed. And it's like, you know, I don't do it every day. You know, I just, like, even today when we get done talking, I have two things I'm going to get done today. Those are my two things, you know, and I try not to get down on myself on the things I don't get done. But like tomorrow, I'm going to start working on my fall, one of my fall classes, because we don't know yet, you know, if we're going to have to do online or in person. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to make my outline for how I want my fall to go for this one class. And then I'm going to try to start to fill in those blanks. Right. And then I'm going to set that aside.
Yep.
And then, you know, Friday will be another print day or something. But so like I think if you could try to be intentional with your time, which people talk about all the time, but it's really true. Like, just try to block certain, even when you don't feel like it. And I think it's times when, like, if I didn't feel like I could write very well or whatever, then I would just, like, make the list of the brainstorm things I need to talk about in it. Or I would write the captions, or I'd try to at least find the images that need to go with that chunk that I need to write about, you know? So I would say that, you know, like, just try to do small tasks every day towards the bigger tasks, you know. But if you leave stuff till the end and think you're going to write this magnificent narrative, I'm here to tell you you're not.
Ooh, that's a disaster.
You know, Neil.
I do. Yeah, definitely not a night before type of thing.
No. I mean, it's not going to go well. And so I would say do the time of the small tasks, you know, and then just they'll build into the big thing.
Absolutely. Well, we are almost at the end of our interview or our time together. Are there any other parting thoughts or upcoming projects that you'd like to talk about? And there doesn't have to be, but yeah. I just like to leave time.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, I know where some people were at, and it's challenging when you're like, oh, will I make tenure, will I not? And I would encourage you to feel like, you know, just do your best on all those things. And Neil, I think I told you this. It's like, if it's meant to be, you'll be there.
Yep.
And if not, then you're meant to be doing something else. And it might seem kind of hard at the time, but, you know, sometimes you just kind of have to walk those different paths and then new things kind of break out. You know, like, I don't know why I felt overwhelmed and had to quit that round one, you know, but I think I look back and it really was the incubator time for the company. I did a lot of stuff on the company building at that point, which if I hadn't had that time, I may have not been able to do all the shifting that I did later, you know? And
yeah.
So, I just try to, I think, you know, it's like really hard when the path before you, you're like, I don't know, what should I do? And I would just say, like, lean in a direction, go towards it and see what happens. And if it's not right, you'll know. And then you'll just shift directions. But sometimes I think we feel like we've got to make these momentous decisions or big, you know, as I can tell you right now with this quarantine situation, you know, I have no idea how the shop's going to fare through this. I mean,
yep.
I'm thankful I don't have a huge payroll, but you know, for us, we're going to like, all right, we're going to go through the summer, see how it goes. We're going to go through the fall and see how that goes. And then in the new year, we'll kind of make some decisions, you know, if I
yep.
need to move home or stay here or what we need to do, you know, like, but I can't run 20 steps ahead. I got to just like, all right, what can I do today to improve the situation? And I'm not going to like worry about the 6 months from now because who knows?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to plan for that right
now.
Yeah,
and I think the quarantine has been helpful in that way of saying, all right, I'm just going to try to live each day how I can. You know, it's
yep.
the same, you know, just same yep. thing with like this big tenure process. Just do the small steps of the things that you need to do to make tenure, and then they'll build into the bigger thing.
Yes. And just to let everyone know, where this is being recorded in April, the end of April, 2020. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sarah.
Yeah. Thank you, Neil.
This concludes season 2, episode 3 of Tell It to Neil. If any of the facts or information included in this episode are incorrect, please feel free to get in touch through our email, hello@tellittoneil.com. If you would like to get in touch with Sarah, please contact her through her website at www.thepermanentcollection.net.